محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Doing a song from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Russia says that Kiev's counteroffensive has not gained much, while Ukraine is boasting of what it calls taking the war to Russia. More and more drone attacks are being conducted on the Russian capital, as well as targets in the Black Sea recently. Now, Russia, of course, saying it's shot down most of the drones and missiles. Now, most recent attacks focusing on Russian-controlled Donbas region and on the other side, Ukrainian facilities in Kharkiv and Zaporizhia. Stay with us for a discussion of the Ukraine-Russia war in this episode of The Spotlight. Let me introduce our guests. John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst, is joining me from Belgrade. Also with us today is Scott Bennett, who's a political commentator out of San Francisco. Okay, beginning with John Bosnich, you know, Kiev is claiming that its drones have put a Russian Black Sea fleet vessel out of action in such a way it's no more able to perform combat missions. You know, on Thursday night, at least 10 attacks using drone boats were reportedly conducted in the Black Sea, and they targeted Russian military ships. I want to ask you, how significant do you think this could be?
Well, every stage of elevation of the level of the conflict is, of course, going to create new challenges. But we know from past experience until this stage that Russia has been able to respond more quickly on the field and in the air and on the water than Ukraine, because Russia is producing its own equipment. Russia is producing its own responses, and Russia is dominating the drone war already.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Scott, the Ukrainian Navy, some people say that because the Navy is not powerful enough to challenge the Russian military, still their drones are relatively cheap, they're accessible and effective, and they could provide a relatively fast and low-profile threat to Russian military ships, particularly when such attacks happen overnight. Now, could the use of drones prove to be a game-changer in the war?
No, not at all. They're more like annoying flies that may cause irritating bites. But when you find the nest and destroy it, you destroy the flies. And I think Russia is adapting its countermeasures to do exactly that. So they have been annoyed by drones slamming into financial districts in Moscow. They have been annoyed by cluster bombs being shelled on civilian areas and sea drones, you know, ramming into ships. But Russia's been prepared for that, and as your previous guest said, they have been producing far superior weaponry in far superior numbers, superior tanks, hypersonic missiles, a morally inspired military, full-spectrum dominance on the information field, on the surveillance field, on the satellite field. Mm-hmm. They have far superior weapons, and they've been fighting this in a defensive way in order to win the diplomatic soft power of the majority of the world's nations. So there's a kinetic aspect, which you see the Ukrainian army dropping from 500,000 to 43,000 men, many of whom don't want to serve. Many of them are defecting because they've seen so many soldiers in Ukraine having their organs cut out for the black market organ harvesting that the U.S. has also been doing. There's also the moral component of the biochemical labs, which the United States had in Ukraine. So the kinetic factors, the moral factors, the international diplomatic soft power war is all going towards Russia's column. And the overall support of the world, I think, is on Russia's side and not with Ukraine or America. because we're witnessing the hypocrisy and the underlining evil that has animated this U.S.-Ukraine proxy war, which has been nothing but genocide.
All right, now, John, let's take a look at another aspect of this war. Russian officials saying that Ukraine has hit the Donetsk University building using cluster shells, and that has caused widespread damage. And Kyiv had promised, when receiving this aid, not to use this Western-provided cluster munitions inside Russian soil and against civilians. So why doesn't the U.S. make an objection to Kyiv that's using these weapons that are banned by more than 120 countries?
I hope you're joking, because the United States doesn't care what the world thinks at all. The United States is using the conflict in Ukraine to set brother against brother. This is the old role that the English used to play around the world. Gandhi once said that if you want to know where the British have been, where the English have been in particular, you can go far, far out of the city into the forest and find a little stream. And if you find two brother fish at each other's throats, you know the English have been there. And that's what the Americans have inherited from England, their colonial founders. And that's what they're doing now. And they're trying to make a war between the Ukrainian people and the Russian people that will make them hate each other forever. And among that hate environment, the Americans would like to place their nuclear weapons, their hydrogen bombs, their attack-oriented weaponry to destroy the Russian Federation. That's the real story of what's happening here. And that's why the Russian army is moving so slowly. That's why the Russian army is trying everything it can to avoid civilian casualties and to minimize the number of Ukrainians who are killed. Basically, the Ukrainians who are being killed in this war are the fanatical neo-Nazis and the men under their command who are being driven from behind by their officers with guns at their backs to die on the tank traps and the barbed wire that Russia has put up to defend the civilian population of ethnic Russians in Ukraine.
I see. Now, Scott, let's talk about peace now. Saudi Arabia, as you may know, has hosted this peace conference on the Ukraine war. There were representatives from around 40 countries like Brazil, the UK, India, China, the US, Turkey, South Africa. Also, some EU countries were also in attendance. Everyone except Russia. So my first question is, why should Russia be excluded?
Well, I think Russia is aware that Saudi Arabia is doing this on its with the permission of Russia. Saudi Arabia isn't just doing this as a countermeasure to jeopardize its relationship or turn cold its warming opportunities with Russia. I think Saudi Arabia made full secret diplomatic connections with Russia and said, we would like to try and step in and see what we can cultivate with Ukraine. And Russia said, yes, go ahead. We're happy to do that. Russia isn't obsessive or narcissistic settling of this. They have their absolute values and requirements, and they're not going to budge on those because they've set their requirements as, we need the following done in order to preserve our people, our culture, and this is an existential threat. No nuclear weapons in Ukraine, no biochemical weapons in Ukraine, no NATO membership in Ukraine, and no Nazi regime in Ukraine, period. End of story. Until that's done, we're going to have to chop down the grass until it's left is nothing but a desert oblivion. So Saudi Arabia stepping in, I think, is actually going to try and persuade Ukraine to adopt Russia's more than gracious offerings that they did last spring in order to preserve their life. But knowing the Ukrainian Zelensky U.S. puppet, the Biden administration, which your guest previously said is very right, the Americans don't care about a Ukrainian. They want to annihilate the entire country if they think it can hurt Russia in one small way. Well, that's the weak point, because Russia can advertise that in a soft war, propaganda, psychological war, and advertise to the entire population, the West is using you, brutalizing you, organ harvesting you, and destroying you for its own purposes. Come back and let brother and brother seek amends, seek a peaceful collaboration, and you need a third party to do that. Now, an interesting thing would be if Iran stepped in and added to this peace negotiation alongside Saudi Arabia, because Iran is very solidly, I think, on Russia's side. Russia knows that. And Saudi Arabia would be forced to soften any of its requirements if Iran was part of it. So this is a multipolar world, soft power diplomatic settlement that's in process. Okay.
Now, John, regarding this Saudi initiative, the press agents there has announced that mainly national security advisors were participating in the consultations that Riyadh hopes would come up with peaceful ways to resolve the war in Ukraine. Do you expect this Saudi initiative to be a success, or is it going to be a non-starter?
Well, it's definitely not a non-starter. It's already started. I mean, that's point number one, and I think that I agree with he's exactly on the mark here, that there is no chance whatsoever that Saudi Arabia, after its warming of relations with Russia and after its contact with Iran recently, is going to start trying unilaterally to intervene in this affair. So Russia is definitely has already set the line in the sand that the ethnic Russian population of Ukraine is not going back to Ukraine. They have been annexed. They are a part proper of Russia, and that is non-negotiable. So by allowing Saudi Arabia to begin some preliminary pre-negotiations, Saudi Arabia can deliver that very message, that under no circumstances is there any chance whatsoever of the annexed territory of Russia being returned to Ukraine as some sort of a gift, as it was given in the past. Mm-hmm. We know that Crimea was gifted to Ukraine. That kind of mistake, that kind of naivete, has been shattered by the neo-Nazis in Ukraine, by Zelensky's puppet operation under U.S. control, and by the gung-ho attitude of NATO, who just wants another war to drive their economies, which are all failing. Those are all non-starters. Mm-hmm. Saudi Arabia is delivering the message. And I do agree with your other guest that this is an opportunity for Iran, which has excellent ties with Russia, which has excellent ties with China, to also join in bringing the stubborn, close-minded, and extremist Ukrainians to the peace table, because they're either going to get bombed there or they're going to get convinced to go there.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay. Now, Scott, let's speaking of peace, let's look at the two conflicting sides. Demands Zelensky, for instance, proposed a 10-clause peace plan in November 2022. It includes mutual exchange of prisoners, ensuring nuclear, food, and energy security, withdrawal of all Russian forces from Ukraine, and the restoration of the complete territorial integrity of his country. Your assessment of the plan, is it logical and feasible?
No, it's fanatical, it's delusional, it's emotionally schizophrenic, and that's exactly what the West, American specific, has become. And your other guest has said it well. Not one inch of Russian territory is going to be returned to Ukraine, because we've seen Ukrainians do to the Eastern Ukrainians, the Russians. They torture them. They organ harvest them. They do horrific acts of torture, crimes against humanity. They're taught to do this by the Mossad. They're taught to do this by the CIA. They're given drugs by the U.S., methamphetamines and ecstasy and things that animate them into zombie-like soldiers. That's a reality. So no part of Ukraine is going to be returned to Russia. And why should they? Because Russia's already been lied to by the Minsk agreements, by Germany, by France. So there's nothing the U.S. or Germany or France or NATO can say to Russia that can be relied upon. And I think Russia also recognizes that NATO as a whole is a paper tiger. It has 600 tanks. Russia has 900. Russia has hypersonic missiles. It has nuclear torpedoes that'll travel around the world. It has far superior technology and weapons than the West have, because they make weapons to defend their people and their culture. The West makes weapons to enrich the military-industrial complex. And I think you're witnessing also a very dangerous situation that may develop as a false flag, where Joe Biden, the zombified American president, who's a coup d'etat against President Trump, Joe Biden most likely is going to allow a black flag, false flag event in Zaporizhzhia, the nuclear plant, or somewhere else, perhaps in the United States, and blame Russia for that. Mm-hmm. In order to try and initiate a draft and larger war, but I think
of course,
it'll fail.
IAEA chief was there, and he spoke of existence of no explosive in that infrastructure. Anyway, now, John, talking of peace, President Zelensky is also calling for security guarantees for Ukraine and the creation of an international mechanism to compensate for his country's financial losses, and that by using Russian assets. Your take?
Absurd. The war started in 2014. That's point number one. That was when the United States admittedly, at their own admission, said that they spent $5 billion, that's just the publicly released data, to stage a coup d'etat to illegally, by force of violence, overthrow the legally elected president of Ukraine. In so doing, they kicked off a war that was running for 8 full years before Russia even entered the war. Then Russia tried to protect the people who were being subjected to genocide. And let me tell you, genocide is nothing new for the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians killed 200,000 Jews after World War I. Then they killed 250,000 Poles between the two wars. Ukrainians have been committing genocide since before the word genocide was invented. This is a nation which has been misled and which has been deceived into thinking that they have nothing to do with Russia, their closest blood brothers. They are victims of their colonizers. They are victims of the West, and they are victims of the American military-industrial complex that has a bunch of garbage weapons that they need to have destroyed. And I can tell you one thing, Russia is going to destroy those weapons. And when those weapons are destroyed, the U.S. taxpayer is going to see a bill in the trillions to replace them, because that's the only thing driving the U.S. economy. So Russia and Ukraine are at war now because the United States does not know how to make money anymore. They can't compete with China. They can't compete militarily with Russia. So they send the Ukrainians to die en masse to fill their pockets full of blood money. That's what's happening here. And anybody who says differently is either being paid by the United States or simply has an extremely low IQ.
Okay. Now, Scott, let's look at the other side. We talked about Zelensky's demands. Now, on the other side, we have Russian President Putin saying in this recent meeting where it got together African leaders in St. Petersburg, talking about grain deal and all that, that his country is ready for dialogue. As long as Ukraine is fighting, Russia cannot sit idle by and watch. They have to fight. That's what Putin said. But he said that he's there for dialogue if, for instance, Africa or China does the mediation. So given all what we've said so far, Zelensky's conditions and the war and all that's going on, what's the prospect of peace?
Well, the peace will come when Russia has annihilated Zelensky, either in his mansion in Florida or in Kiev or wherever he may be, along with his Nazi fanatics. That's when Russia will establish peace. They cannot establish peace where Zelensky remains alive or his regime remains in power, because then that cancer will grow as it did in the Minsk agreement. So Russia is going to be annihilating this echelon of leadership, and to try and do a cleansing of the the leprosy and the gangrene that has infected the body politic of Ukraine. And I think the diplomatic efforts of Africa, of Saudi Arabia, hopefully of Iran, since Iranians, the Persians are far more intelligent when it comes to these sort of historical diplomatic engagements than many of the rest of the world. They're an ancient culture. And I think Iran could step in and do some magnificent diplomatic overtures to Zelensky and the regime to say, pack up your bags and leave, and you'll be alive. Don't do it, and you'll be dead, as will your entire progeny. So there won't be any peace until Russia decides that the conditions warrant peace. Because, again, remember, Russia sees this, and the world begins to see this as a existential battle for the world. If Ukraine falls to the U.S. Imperialism, then they will use that as a platform to attack Russia. Right. When Russia goes into breakup, then they'll attack Iran and China. So the world has to stand against this hegemonic empire.
Now, John, the West support is going on despite their own issues on home turf. Is it really worth all the trouble? And when it comes to the U.S., does the U.S. really want peace, or it wants the war to go on? How much longer is it going to help Kiev with ammo and military hardware, despite all the issues it has back home?
In the United States, it's no longer possible to refer to God. If you mention God, you're violating the Constitution. Yet it still says, "In God we trust," on their dollar bill. And that is their God. Mammon is the God of the United States. They do not care how many people die. They do not even care how many Americans die. They sent thousands and thousands of hundreds of thousands of Americans into Vietnam. 55,000 Americans died there with no result, except for the fact that the military-industrial complex had a war for 15 years in which everything they could make was being sold, and everybody who could work for them was making a salary. And the owners of the military-industrial complex and the banksters who run the U.S. political system, who buy the candidates, right, who set the agenda, were making themselves richer and richer. That's what America wants. The idea that America is doing anything today out of altruism, out of idealism, is so passé that I'd have to ask if the person is in a sleeping chamber from 100 years ago. There is no idea in Washington about doing something good for Ukraine. What they're doing is they're attacking Russia and using the Ukrainian people as a bloody battering ram.
All right. Scott, there are some analysts, observers, many of them calling this a war of attrition that would not end as long as the West keeps pouring in weaponry into Ukraine. Your opinion on that? We have only 1 minute left.
Well, the weaponry will be basically unmanned because all the Ukrainians are going to be dead or shattered and unable to manage it, or they will be refusing to pick up and use those arms. That's the level this is approaching, the complete disintegration and disintegration of the Ukrainian army. Now, many of these weapons are going to end up along the Mexican border, and the cartel drug clans are going to be using those against the American southern border of Texas, California, Arizona, and New Mexico. That's the new flashpoint that many in the military are looking at as a result of this war. And you'll see also those weapons be used in Europe as the European, governments begin to encounter more and more disruptions and revolutionary protests.
Okay, unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much, John Bostich in Belgrade, Scott Bennett in San Francisco.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality. It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, sisters and brothers from all around the world, from every single corner of this world. Welcome back to a new episode of Back to Reality. Well, this is IRB English Radio, and I'm Asma as your host. Once more, I have the pleasure to be here with Brother Mustafa and Brother Abdullah. Assalamu alaikum, brothers.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Oh, well, I'd like it if you introduce yourself briefly.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. So my name is Sayyid Abdullah al-Musawi, teacher, student, seeker, preacher of Islamic knowledge in general.
Yeah. And you, Brother Mustafa?
My name is Sayyid Mustafa. I am a student here and I'm studying psychology here in Qom.
Well, very good. Right now, at the age that we're living, there are some concepts that I look at them as the sort of keys that have been lost. One of them is politeness. When I see how the youngsters would treat the elder ones, I just feel so disappointed. Because I would think, of course, of the day that I'm going to be considered as an old woman, then I can't imagine then how would my niece treat me. And then that really bugs me to see her to be so headless toward the behaviors she's going to have with me. Can you please define politeness?
Sure. I think in the word that we have in, I believe it's in Arabic, is adab. I don't think that quite translates as politeness. It can translate as politeness. It can translate as mannerisms. It can translate as a way of doing things, right?
Manners is a better. Yeah.
And adab, I think, for me, it's the way of doing anything. For example, if I'm writing, the adab of writing is to make it as beautiful as possible.
Exactly.
So that's what adab does. It makes an action even more better or more beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's lost in today's culture, in today's TikTok culture, where everything is about 5 seconds and it's about offending people or insulting. I mean, a lot of the patience that comes with learning things the proper way, it's lost. Right? People just want shortcuts. They just want instant results. Whereas adab says, hey, you need patience. You need to learn things the best way to do them. And that's really important. Another point, which I think we talked about earlier, was in different cultures, it can be different as well. So we have to be aware that sometimes things don't always translate in the same way. I remember when I came to Iran, one thing that's different here is that they really hate burping. Right? If you were to burp in public here, it's like people get really offended. Whereas in Pakistan, it's pretty normal. It's considered natural. It's even considered almost a positive thing to burp after certain meals in certain places. Mm-hmm. So certain things can translate in different places.
When it comes to adab, it's a big topic that's you can hardly pinpoint to a geographical location or a culture. Having said that, there are principles that we need to maintain when we deal with one another in terms of physical contact and verbal contact. So there are certain principles that all humanity agree on wherever you go, that you need to maintain the certain etiquettes and certain behaviors that you need to have when you deal with your fellow human being. And you have to deal with him in a manner where you're not upsetting him physically or verbally. You can put, adab or morals or values around that context. But having said that, like maintaining the principles and the details, like they say, the devil, the details. The details will differ. The details will, from culture to culture, would obviously differ. So it's really hard to say this is the adab, this is the adequate, or this is the morals.
To give it an exact definition.
Like I said, I can give you a definition from what? From an Islamic perspective, from like the Arabic culture perspective, from whose perspective?
Let's go for it from Islamic perspective.
Yeah, so from Islamic perspective, adab is when you are maintaining your akhlaq, maintaining your chastity, maintaining your haya, maintaining a number of things. You put them together that constitute adab, because adab is not just a mufrada by itself. It's not just a concept by itself. It's made up from different concepts. So when Allah says to the Prophet, إِنَّكَ لَعَلَى خُلُقٌ عَظِيمٌ, you have the highest morality or possess the highest level of morality. There are a number of things. Is the way he talks to people, the way people trust him.
His manners.
Yeah, so manners itself is a number of things. So there are hundreds of things that you need to have in order for you to become more adab.
My understanding of adab was that it's whatever makes that action more complete or more better or beautiful. That was my definition of adab. Is that correct?
It's correct, like you said, the example that you gave, this might be correct if you're addressing a certain country, a certain culture, But it will change then.
No, what I was saying, it could be anything. It could be just, you know, talking, it could be writing, it could be performing, anything, but it comes with its own principles. And when you apply those principles, it makes that action better.
That's to care more about what you say or what you do.
Yeah.
I guess.
So, we have a whole science called akhlaq, mm-hmm. right? That yeah. we should deal with. Akhlaq is basically adabs. Once you obtain all these, and you become a good person. Then this is how I see it. Being a person of adab is meaning that when you talk to a person, you observe their situation, like physically and mentally, and care about them. So I talk to you, I'm always on my guard, making sure I don't say anything that offends you or do something that offends you. And this is basically what adab is, in mm-hmm. my perspective. Yeah. I have to make sure that you're constantly happy as long as you're in my presence. Hmm. You know, I'm not harming you, not physically. Or like, for example, burping, right?
Yeah.
I couldn't burp. It could be good and, you know, no one cares about it. But then I said, well, would he like it? Would she like it if I do it in front of them? Regardless of, like, maybe, maybe not. So because since it's a maybe, let me hold it back.
Yeah, so to care more and to think more about
what
you
do. Be more caring and being more conscious of this, of the person in front of you.
Yeah.
This is how I
still, I guess, if we ask the audience about the definition, every single person is going to give their own perspective and their own definition. Speaking of adab, or the manners, or whatever thing that would come into your mind as we talk about adab, that is, well, literally, it comes as politeness, but as Brother Abdullah and as Brother Mustafa mentioned it, it's going to be a combination of many things together. So speaking of it, of this mannerism, we come to the story of Karbala. So why is it that when everybody talks about Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas alayhi salam, they come to say, okay, he was the master of mannerism. He was the paragon of mannerism.
Yeah. I think what we see in Karbala is the most extreme situation that anyone can be in, right? They were fighting for their lives. Mm-hmm. They were thirsty. They were hungry. But beside those extreme conditions, we see that their behavior and their mannerisms were exemplary. That to this day, we remember it, we learn it, we tell our kids, you know, you need to be like that. You need to be like mm-hmm. Hussein. You need to be. So I think that's why it becomes so important that they were in such extreme conditions, yet, despite that, they had the most perfect character.
Exactly.
I mean, you could be in a very easy condition. You could be, you know, in the Himalayas and sitting in the jungle and have good character. You could be a monk, right? But that's not as valuable as someone who's almost about to die in the middle of the desert.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. Being a monk in that situation, I think, is something we can learn from.
I'm an extremely emotional person, especially when it comes to the Ahl Bayt. So I try to avoid answering any question because then there will be a lot of stops. Because I'm, like, you know, my emotions take the best of me. The Ahl Bayt Salam Allah Alayhim in general, or the even through the Karbala, the Ahl Bayt, Imam Hussain Alayhi Salam, Abu al-Fadl Abbas, Ali al-Akbar, all the companions, they always maintain their akhlaq because obviously, beside the fact it's an Islamic duty, it's their manner. This is how they are. This is how they've been raised. Having said that, we have to be very careful that the Ahl Bayt Salamullah Alayhim would deal with individuals based on how they approach the Ahl Bayt. So sometimes, for example, when a Shimr came to Abu al-Fadl Abbas and he gave him the letter that said to him, you're safe. Abu al-Fadl Abbas, he wasn't polite to him. He's like, La'anak Allah wa la'ana amirak. May Allah curse you on your, you know, that's not politeness.
But you would say he didn't, like, swear it.
Yeah, no. So he didn't swear. But so I'm saying politeness in the sense of, I was like, okay, you know what? Thank you very much for your offer, but I'm not interested.
Hmm.
No. He took a different approach. When the guy said to him, I said, look, what? You hurried the fire? You want to go to... I'm like, no, may Allah kill you. You may Allah make you die thirsty. So depending on the situation and the person that you deal with, you have to change as well. So you don't, you know, when someone is being nice to you, being nice to them. But someone is rude to you, or someone is being offensive.
What's that verse in the Quran about being compassionate among believers and being hard towards this?
Yeah, ruhama abaynahum. Right. Like they, so when it comes to the moment, ruhama abaynahum, ashidda ala al-kufar. When it comes to the kufar, you have to use...
They're merciful toward each other.
Yeah, and you have to use strength when you're dealing with the enemy. So it depends on how you deal with me. So Abul Fadl Abbas, salamullah alayhi, for example, when it comes to Imam Hussein, when it comes to the family, he showed the most of mercy and compassion and akhlaq. Yeah. When it came to his enemies, he showed different.
But I would say even to the enemies, I agree with your point. But when we're talking adab, we're talking about how to do things.
No, but he maintained the adab.
But I'm saying even in war, they maintained their adab, right?
Yeah,
even when they were killing people, there were certain rules. They weren't killing, like Islam has, like for example, adab for war. You're not allowed to like burn trees.
So
you're
there's adab for war that you would use.
So there's always adab behind it.
Of course. So they, like I said, so when he cursed Shimr, he could have, you know, cursed his mom or his dad. Or
they're always staying within the rules.
Obviously the rules themselves, like they differ from, like when you're in a war, is different one than you are in normal circumstances.
Exactly. So now there's still one more point, but I'd like to go for a short break. And then after that, we do the wrap up.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
This is Back to Reality. Brother Mustafa and Brother Abdullah are talking to us about mannerism. Well, we went through the story of Karbala. We talked about the mannerism of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, and we said that mannerism is actually a combination of many things, but we could just say the gist and put it this way, that it's caring too much about what we do and what we say in order not to make anyone bothered from us. So now the thing that we would wrap the story with it up is the fact that why this fact is lost in today's life.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily lost in today's life. Maybe
At least not that important.
I think the focus
has
been taken off of it, right?
Yeah.
What I mean is, for my understanding of what adab is, like I defined earlier, is things which beautify that action, which things that make better. We're focusing on making the wrong things better, I would
say,
right? Whereas if we were to come back to the real values, to real manners, what we realize is this is what we really need. But one thing I want to add, you, the very first thing you mentioned something about kids, about not being respectful. One thing as a student of psychology, I'm realizing that we need to learn about kids and their needs, right? Sometimes we're judging kids from our point of view, about how we were with our parents.
Mm-hmm.
What we need to know is the kids' needs. And that's also part of mannerisms, is knowing what the person in front of you, what is their needs?
Because we're going
to
teach them with our own behavior.
Right.
So even if you look at literature or the movies or everything that has been created by the artist, then you would see that the classicals were more of mannerist people. They were for manners more than now.
Look, the one thing you got to keep in mind, I think the brother touched upon, is that the moral values themselves are changing. What we perceive to back in the day to be moral and polite.
So we should be more caring, and that's what Allah wants us to do. And yes, thank you for staying with us. And wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al Alameen, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi. Let the ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alameen, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi. Let the ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again. Thank you.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has vowed to address the pressing cost of living crisis plaguing the nation. Attributing the situation to the global economic downturn, Erdogan has assured that his government will swiftly resolve this issue while upholding his promises to the people impacted by the devastating February earthquake. He had previously pledged to complete the reconstruction efforts within a year.
We vow to tackle the escalating cost of living caused by global crisis. We are aware that the cost of living has been suffocating our nation recently. As we have solved every problem of our country, I hope we will solve this problem again. We will not neglect anyone's right and will not leave anyone's expectations unanswered.
Analysts argue that this whole economic crisis is the result of wrong economic strategies and decisions made by the same ruling government for the past years, and they cannot fix what they have done now.
The people who created the problem and don't see it as a problem are very unlikely to fix it. For this reason, it's naive to expect from the creator of the problem to solve the problem. I don't know on what basis the president is making these promises. He spoke about the cost of living, which has been getting higher for the past 2 years. Every month, we have a new raises in prices from foodstuff to rents and fuel. When the new government came and Memi Şimşek was appointed, we waited for something positive to happen. But the lira value against US dollar is dropping, and we are not seeing any investments in the country. So where are all the new policies they want implement?
A few weeks ago, the vice president said that a new economic plan is to be revealed in September that will have a positive impact on the life of citizens, production and market, saying this plan will increase investments in the country.
Turkey, after the pandemic, was facing a few economic issues, just like other countries in the world, struggling to encounter post-lockdown repercussions, and then came the devastating earthquake, and then elections. So what we are facing, from inflation to change in lira value, is normal to what country has been going through. However, I think the government's plan will ease the economic crisis, but it will take time, of course. When speaking about the economy, nothing can happen in one night.
This is why inflation is gaining a new momentum. The annual inflation went up from 38.2% to 47.8% in a single month in July. Lack of economic investments, inflation, low Turkish lira value against the US dollar, and high cost of living. This is how the Turkish economy is going now, with some blaming the pandemic and earthquake, while others say it is the government's wrong economic decisions. Amid the government promises and opposition criticism regarding Erdogan's extended tenure, there remains uncertainty regarding the potential success of the newly appointed economic team in swiftly executing their plans.
It's not that bad. Yes, the Turkish lira value has dropped and the cost of living has risen, but the government also raised the minimum wage and is trying to solve the economic problems which occurred due to the earthquake.
The ruling party must act fast to solve this economic crisis ahead of an upcoming critical local election, which will determine the fate of Istanbul, Ankara, and other major cities. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul. Around 800 delegates from 76 countries have arrived at the International Military Technical Forum held in Moscow region. Their presence showed a desire to strengthen and develop mutually beneficial cooperation with Russia, despite the West's anti-Russian sanctions. Addressing the participants, President Vladimir Putin noted that the U.S., along with NATO members, use all military and non-military means to pressure nations into submitting to their will, adding that all this is taking place amid a disintegrating arms control framework.
In particular, the United States intent on reformatting the existing system of interstate relations in the Asia-Pacific region as it deems fit. In fact, efforts to promote these so-called Indo-Pacific strategies are aimed at creating U.S.-led military and political associations. We cannot exclude that these efforts may pave the way to fully integrate NATO forces with the AUKUS structures as they take shape.
Putin stated Ukraine as a case which demonstrates where the Western policy of pouring oil on fire leads.
By pumping billions of dollars into the neo-Nazi regime and supplying it with equipment, arms and munitions, sending military advisors and mercenaries there, they are doing everything to further escalate the conflict and draw other countries into it.
According to the Russian Defense Minister, Ukraine's military resource is almost exhausted and a special military operation has shown that there is nothing invulnerable to Russian weapons on the battlefield today.
No one should have any illusions that against the backdrop of a special military operation, Russian interests can be harmed. I wanted to draw attention to the fact that we also have cluster munitions in service. Until now, for humanitarian reasons, we have refrained from using them. However, this decision may be reconsidered.
This year, the forum is widely represented by weapons and military equipment that have already proven efficient in action. According to the Russian Defense Minister, the Russian army is expected to sign contracts worth over $4.7 billion at the forum. Iran has also presented a whole range of new combat drones.
Russia has expressed its determination to deepen technological partnerships and military technical cooperation with other countries and also continue taking advantage of the already established cooperation ties. The Army Expo's success is a clear indication that the West has lost most of its power in forcing countries to bend to its will. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
For the fourth time in 5 months, ex-President Donald Trump has been indicted and will be forced to stand trial, this time over alleged 2020 election interference in the state of Georgia. Ex-New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani joins Trump and nearly 20 others who will be collectively tried for violating a law normally associated with gangsters.
The indictment alleges that rather than abide by Georgia's legal process for election challenges, the defendants engaged in a criminal racketeering enterprise to overturn Georgia's presidential election result.
A conviction of racketeering in Georgia has a minimum prison sentence of 5 years. Polls have Trump as a certain lock to win the Republican presidential nomination, and he's neck and neck with incumbent President Joe Biden for next year's election. Trump has gained 8 points among Republicans and Republican-leaning independents since the first indictment was handed down, as the spate of court cases has many accusing the ruling party of persecuting political opponents.
I definitely think it's a witch hunt because, I mean, it's like crying wolf. How many times are they going to say he's indicted? And I just think, I do believe that it's also election interference. I believe that they really don't want him to run the establishment. I believe that they want to keep Biden in office.
A recent poll found that 12% of America says that the use of force is justified to keep Trump from winning the presidency, while 7% of Trump supporters say force is justified to restore Trump to the presidency.
I absolutely support it. And, I was just talking to my son yesterday when the fourth came through. And I'm like, you know, it's just hard for me to imagine that you could have someone, the leader of one of the world's best countries or used to be in the world, and he could try to overthrow a legitimate campaign vote. So, no, I'm all for the indictments.
The Georgia trial is the only of Trump's four indictments, which is likely to be televised. The indictments have often seemed timed to coincide to overshadow developments in the corruption allegations of Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden.
You know, we've been saying for a while that Trump is a criminal, and the issue is that we have a criminal system. So, you know, Trump being indicted, we hope that he goes to jail. We hope that he goes to prison. I don't think that it's going to happen personally. But at the same time, you know, some of the people who are pushing these charges, you know, are also a part of this criminal system and also, you know, need to be held accountable for the things that they've done.
Trump's goal may be to delay the trials past the November 2024 vote, although he cannot pardon himself in the Georgia case, while Democrats are accused of slow-walking the investigations to tarnish Trump throughout the upcoming election campaign.
What the continued lawsuits make certain is that there will be no national reconciliation over the still disputed 2020 election, only further estrangement, and with no end in sight. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
On the 17th anniversary of the 2006 Israeli war against Lebanon, Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah underlined the prospects of the resistance front in the entire region.
I do not deny, as the Israeli war minister threatened, that they can take Lebanon back to the Stone Age. But I tell our enemy, based on evidence and facts, you also will be taken to the Stone Age. If you choose to go to war with Lebanon, you will be returned to the Stone Age. Our enemy can make a list of civilian and military obvious infrastructure in the area of occupied Palestine. They can calculate how many rockets the resistance needs to destroy all of these sites.
The Hezbollah leader stressed that the resistance in Lebanon and Palestine and the Resistance Alliance of the region have seized the initiative to a very high extent.
August 14, 2006, did not only signal the end of 33 days of Israeli hostilities, but it ushered in a new phase in the Israeli-Arab conflict. For the first time since its creation, Israel has been deterred from launching a new aggression for 17 years.
Western and Israeli reports published since the end of the 2006 war and until today mentioned that Hezbollah had a decisive victory over Israel with a lasting impact.
Any Western who was has a freedom or was liberal to say the truth would do nothing but acknowledge the truth about the resistance and honor them, because in their books and their reports they acknowledge that those people performed very highly and they were not scared and they were facing the tanks and the airplanes and all of this with their humble weapons. But as the other brother said, but they had a spirit that the Israeli will never have because they're fighting for good cause.
Observers believe the war has set the cornerstone for a new age for the peoples of this region and the whole world.
What this victory has done to the mentalities is building a new way of thinking, way of victorizing against the enemies, especially the West and its culture. They cannot invade us again.
Israel's aggression killed around 1,300 Lebanese, mostly civilians. It destroyed thousands of residential buildings and houses and severely damaged Lebanese civil infrastructure and displaced approximately 1 million Lebanese. Maryam Saleh, Mlita, South Lebanon.
Groundwater pollution has reached an alarming level in the Gaza Strip. The enclave's coastal aquifer is almost completely polluted with various contaminants, posing grave risks for Gazans. Israel has imposed tight restrictions on the entry of badly needed equipment to maintain water and sewage systems and targeted them during wars. Water pollution poses serious health risks throughout the tiny coastal sliver.
The Israeli continuous blockade has severe implications on the situation of water in Gaza. 97% of the Gaza aquifer water is polluted due to the destruction happened on the last offensives that we witnessed in Gaza Strip.
More than 2 million Gazans are forced to buy filtered water in order to cook or drink. Tap water in Gaza is unfit for human consumption. People only use it for house cleaning and doing the laundry.
Tap water is not suitable for drinking, and I think it's not even good for animals to drink. Tap water makes us sick, and we only use it to wash our clothes and to clean the house. My family spends a lot of money to buy filtered water. We only use filtered water to cook and drink.
Inhumane Israeli practices have taken their toll on the coastal slivers drinking water. Water contamination levels are at least 3 times higher than the standards of the World Health Organization for safe drinking water.
More than 97% of Gaza's groundwater is polluted and does not meet the standards of the World Health Organization. The blockade and repeated Israeli military operations and the direct targeting of Gaza's vital infrastructure have also caused damage to water systems and affected water supply networks, further exacerbating the already existing water crisis.
The consumption of contaminated water at levels over international safety standards can cause potentially life-threatening diseases.
Years of Israeli siege and multiple wars since 2008 have devastated Gaza's water infrastructure and led to increasing levels of pollution in drinking water supplies. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Afghan women's restaurant is situated in the capital, Kabul, and serves traditional Afghan food. The restaurant is decorated with colorful fabrics, handicrafts, and flowers, and it is known for being run by and for women. The owners say it is a safe haven for women who want to enjoy a meal, socialize, and express themselves freely.
This restaurant is established to serve and help women. All of our employees and customers are women. We wanted to create a space where women can feel comfortable and hopeful and enjoy tasty Afghan traditional food. It's also aimed at offering jobs to women who are left without an income.
The women who work at the facility say they started working here after the Taliban banned them from other jobs and education. They call on the de facto government to reverse the restrictions on women's rights.
I was a student of law when the Taliban enforced the ban on universities. At the time, I felt so bad and depressed. In addition, our family was running out of money. Then I decided to join this restaurant. It is very beneficial and helpful for me. I call on the Taliban to restore our rights to work and education.
The restaurant is popular among women who come here to enjoy the food and the atmosphere. The customers say they appreciate the service and the solidarity that they find here.
I am a 12th grade student. I visit this restaurant because it is run by and for women. I come here to study, have Afghan hand-baked food, and socialize with my friends. I also want to meet new people and chat with them. I'm happy that at least we have this opportunity and service.
The restaurant is a rare example of women's empowerment and resistance in a country where the Taliban have imposed strict restrictions on women's rights. Despite the challenges and risks, Afghan women are not giving up on their dreams and aspirations. They're supportive of each other in the face of the imposed restrictions. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Seventy-5 years after their forced displacement during the Nakba, Palestinian refugees are concerned about the dire financial crisis facing the UNRWA. Since its establishment in 1949 by the UN General Assembly, UNRWA has dedicated all its effort to help protect the Palestinian refugees by providing humanitarian services and supporting their education. 2023 marks the most dangerous year for over 5 million Palestinian refugees spread across the occupied territories, Jordan, Lebanon, and other countries.
UNRWA's financial crisis started since signings of the Oslo Accord. It is mainly a political crisis, not financial, aroused by the U.S. administrations and the EU. The crisis is worsening every year, especially in Gaza. The donor countries have defunded and stopped their aids.
Here is where Hatem Mihjiz, a Palestinian refugee, father of eight, was born after his father was displaced. He and his family are facing a serious situation